Some of you won't know, I have three daughters. And this afternoon, Jen hilariously sent me out shopping with them. Very interesting. I've survived and I'm here. So, I mean, that's the main thing, isn't it? But we are in the middle of an epic series in the book of Hebrews. And I love Sam. He's just super encouraging. Do you know what I mean? You're like, I could say something. Anyway, Hebrews as a book, I would say, is theologically dense, if that makes sense to you. Or another expression might be meaty. And you have different kinds of books in life, don't you? I don't know, when you go on holiday and you have a little read, do you take something quite light with a story? I'm a Clive Cussler kind of guy, do you know what I mean? It's like something really low bar, whereas my wife, Jen, is much more of a Man Booker Prize. So I don't really know what to buy her. It's got a prize. It's going to be great. I'm going to get her that. And I would say that Hebrews is the latter. It's more like a Man Booker Prize. It's rich, it's deep, it's meaty, it's fulsome, and it's a massive meal. And so really what you're going to get today is a five-course meal. And I hope you enjoy it. Now, Hebrews as a book is an incredibly important book. Outside of the Gospels, which obviously talk a lot about Jesus, Hebrews is the book that is most centered on the person of Jesus and the saving work of Jesus, and really what he's done for us, why he's so important, why it's worth giving our lives for. And so that's what we're going to be in today. It's also a deeply encouraging book. We know this because the whole book, right at the end in chapter 13, it says this: it's a word of encouragement and exhortation. So we come away from it lifted up. And Hebrews exalts Jesus in the most expressive language. And I believe it will exhort and call you to love and lift him up. I don't remember whether you remember, but about 6 or 7 months ago, we did a series to hit... He will be exalted. It was like on the tip of my tongue. Do you know, it's very late for me now. But he will be exalted, like imprinted on my mind. But he will be exalted. That he will be exalted to his rightful place. But so on the one hand, Hebrews is an incredibly encouraging book. On the other, I think that no book, maybe outside of Revelation, instills quite as much godly fear in us as well. And I think there are two sides to the book. It's both encouraging and real. And it makes us tremble at the thought of walking away from Jesus as well. And so there are two sides to it. Now, our series is called Fix Our Eyes Upon Jesus, Fix Your Eyes Upon Jesus. And in this ever-changing, slightly overwhelming, beautiful world, it's pronouncing and exhorting and saying Jesus is the cornerstone. He is unchanging. And in order to deal with all that life throws at us, we have to fix our eyes on him. And when I think about this kind of analogy of fix your eyes on Jesus, I think when horses are sent into racing, when they go racing, what they have is they have blinkers put on them, because actually what happens is they can often get quite distracted and they're like, oh, look at that thing over there. In the same way, it's like, fix your eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of your faith. That's the encouragement throughout Hebrews. It's like, you've got to do that. And sometimes in order to do that, we need blinkers. It's like, oh, I need to not get distracted. I need to not go all the way over there. It's like, fix your eyes on him. And that's really what the series is talking about. So, quick recap, Paul started off the series by talking about Jesus our King. Alice picked it up the week after, Jesus our Rescuer, Dave Pike, Jesus our Rest last week. And so today I am talking about Jesus our Great High Priest. So we're going to pick it up in chapter 4, verses 14 to 16. So if you've got a Bible, just grab them. If not, it will come up on the screen behind me. And this passage that we're looking at functions as a bridge between the first four chapters and what's the next section, really, which is chapters 5 to 10, which I'm going to introduce. And really, it acts as a bit of a springboard in this moment. The first four chapters are really just setting out that Jesus is more incredible. Jesus is more amazing than all of these people, than the angels it starts off with, than Moses, than Joshua. It's like Jesus is higher than all of these. But his greatest greatness is in this, his primary role and function as great high priest. And so we're going to pick it up, verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who's ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who's unable to empathize with our weakness. But we have one who's been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. So this, the final verse, verse 16, talks about receiving mercy and finding grace to help us in our time of need. Now, in terms of an image that I'd love to imprint on your mind, you know, sometimes it's like, what did James talk about? What do I go away with? I want to give you this idea of the throne room. And that when you picture Jesus, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and you come into the throne room, that you remember that that throne room is filled with grace. It's filled with grace and mercy. And that's the throne room that you're coming into. As we've mentioned before, the context of this is it's written into an audience, and that the early Jesus followers that this book was written to were hard pressed. They were suffering persecution. It was really, really difficult. Dave Pike talked last week about how some of them were actually martyred for their faith, that they gave their lives for this. And so it's into this context of persecution, of difficulty, that this letter is written. And some of them were really asking this question, is it worth it? Is it worth it? It's really, really hard. Is it worth giving my life? Is Jesus worth giving my life for? Now, obviously, we're in a different context and a different situation right here, but it's still a question that we ask, isn't it? Is it worth it? Is it worth it? And this book is written to remind them, this is how magnificent Jesus is. And this is why he's worth it. And this is why it's worth giving your life for. Now, if you were to take, that was the situation of the readers, you take our own situations now. All of us are in need. All of us face situations with other people that stretch our wisdom to the limit. All of us encounter struggles and obstacles and roadblocks and landmines in life that we simply don't know how to navigate. That we sit there and we're like, I don't know how to do this. I remember me and Jen having a chat about a month ago, and you think that you're going to reach this point in life where you know how to navigate circumstances. And I think we looked at each other and we're like, we have got no idea what we're doing. Sorry to disappoint some of the younger ones amongst you. No. But you have this moment with the circumstances that come in on your life that you sit there and you go, I do not know how to deal with this. All of us find ourselves in relationships with other people that annoy us and frustrate us and leave us feeling upset and hurt. We're all going to experience that in relationships. Some of us live with crippling doubt and others with paralyzing anxiety. A few might live in fear of the future, while others struggle with regrets from the past. And it really doesn't matter what your biggest problem is today. It doesn't matter whether it's similar to that of the person next to you, or if yours is completely altogether unique. And I'm imagining, because we're all so unique, that the things that we've come in with are unique. It doesn't matter if it's begun recently or if you've been dealing with it for years. The only thing that matters is that you have great need and you know it, and that you turn to the only person and place where genuine life-changing help can be found. That's the only thing that you need to know. The passage talks about great need. We have great need. So verse 16 says this, let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. I started this year by saying that if we could grow in one thing this year, it would be confidence in the power of the gospel. Often I start the year, it's like, da, 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 we've got this brand new idea that we're going after. We're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. And I literally said, if we could do one thing, let's grow in confidence in the power of the gospel. And that is the message that we are going after. This passage is talking about confidence, isn't it? Let us approach the throne of God with confidence. That's the exhortation in this passage. Coming into his presence, receiving grace and mercy. We never get beyond this. But often we stop coming to his throne, coming into his throne room because of wrong thinking and lies. There are things that can get in the way of us moving into that throne room, and I'm going to unpack that later. But this passage today is talking about Jesus, our great high priest, and how we constantly need to come to him. Now, this language of great high priest, some of you are like, I've not really heard this language before. It's not that familiar to you. You might sit there and be like, I've heard of wonderful counselor, almighty God, everlasting father, prince of peace. Some of you have moved into Handel's Messiah at that point, but others, not so much. But our great high priest, that's not necessarily familiar to us. What does that even mean? To the readers of the time, that phrase would have been really obvious. They're like, completely get it. Got it. We're sitting there and be like, okay, what does that mean? And in many senses, it's quite complicated for us, the reader, right now. Because in order for us to really grasp it, we have to understand the Old Testament and how Jesus ushers in the new covenant. And the writer is comparing the old covenant with the new covenant. The ministry of the priest in the Old Testament and how much more incredible Jesus is our high priest now. So that's what I want to look at. So what did the writer mean by priesthood? Now, this is a concept that we do not engage with in our community very often. And it's mainly because in our church, I'm not seen as the mediator between you and God. Thank the Lord. Now, if you've come from a different background, church background, you might actually expect that of me. And I'd very quickly to be like, no. Let's just be really clear. God, me, you, not happening. But I just want to be really clear. And so some of you are like, so what the heck do you do, James? And well, that's a sermon for another time. I've been asking that question myself. What do you do, James? I do have hilarious people, chats with people when they find out I'm a pastor. You know, it's like, oh, talk to me about your role. It's like, oh, okay. You're part of the vineyard. All right, okay. But the point, sorry, I've gone off one. The point I'm trying to make is that I do not stand in the gap as the bridge between God and yourselves. My role, and what I see the role of the leadership of this church, is to point you towards Jesus. We don't mediate between you and the Lord. We point you towards him. Our role is to say, what has God said? How are you meeting the Lord? How are you coming into the throne room of the Lord? Those are the questions that we ask. When you're making a big decision about your life, have you spoken to the Lord about that? That's the kind of thing that we're here to do, to encourage you. Have you sought the Lord's face? And this is all because of the finished work of Jesus on the cross, is that the amazing news is you go straight to him. You don't need us. And it even talks about in the passage that he's actually interceding for us, which is so beautiful. Chapter 5, verse 1, actually really just quickly helps to explain what the role of the priest is. So let's just read that quickly. It says this: every high priest is selected from among the people and is appointed to represent the people in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. So again, this is the Old Testament. What it's saying is there's three different things that this little verse is saying. The first one is that the priest must be chosen from among the people, and he must be able to identify with those who he has to represent. So that's the first one. The second one, this: he must represent people to God. This means that he must be acceptable in the presence of God as he presents his case on their behalf, secondly. And then thirdly, when he represents men to God, he must do so on the basis of worthy gifts and sacrifices. He presents the sacrifices. So in the Old Testament, the priest would offer sacrifices of animals and grain. And in fact, I'm not going to go into this really at all, but just to say, if you read the Old Testament, there's five different types of sacrifices that you'll notice. You'll notice the burnt offering, the grain offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering. It's a lot of offerings, isn't it? There are a lot of specific offerings for different moments, and that's what the role of the priest was, to come before God, to bring the offering before the Lord. But all of these offerings were merely a shadow of what was to come in Jesus. Now, some of you will have heard of a guy called N.T. Wright. and he's written a commentary on this, and he summarizes so succinctly that it's beautiful that I sit there and I'm like, I'm just going to read it. He does such a brilliant job that I'm like, why would I try and summarize it in my own way? Of chapters 4 to 7 that we're looking at, he says this, is that Jesus has fulfilled the ancient promise of God that he would eventually send his people a great high priest who would do so in perpetuity, that really means forever, and perfectly, what the regular priesthood symbolized but could only do in part and imperfectly. Basically, all it's saying is Jesus was the fulfillment of the priesthood. He was the perfect priest. And in chapter 7, it goes on to talk a little bit more why this is so incredible. I'm just going to read it. And this passage, I'm not going to deeply explain it because I think it's really self-explanatory. You read it and you're like, okay, that makes sense. Verse 23 of chapter 7 down to 28, it says this. Now there have been many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office. So this is really the idea. Jesus is a priest forever, isn't he? Because he's eternal. Whereas all of these other priests would have died. So one by one, you had a priest who died, you had another priest who died, another priest. It's like Jesus is eternal. But Jesus lives forever. He has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him because he always lives to intercede for them. Such a high priest truly meets our need. Can you see? There it is again. Meets our need. I talked about that right at the beginning. This idea of when we come in, it's like this priest meets our needs. One who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day. First for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. He was the ultimate sacrifice. He took away this whole sacrificial system of the priest having to offer sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice, 5 different types of sacrifice. In this one moment on the cross and resurrection, Jesus said, I am the ultimate sacrifice. It is done. It is finished, was what he said. It's finished. It's done. I am the finished work. And then what happens is he is exalted. And he goes to be with the Father and he intercedes on our behalf. He is the ultimate mediator. Jesus is the mediator. Can you see? That's why we don't need the priesthood in the same way. It's like, I don't need to be a priest mediating between you and God. You go straight to him. You go straight to Jesus. He is the mediator. And this incredible image of him interceding with the Father, interceding for us. It's beautiful. Now, I'm aware that talking about Jesus, our great high priest, can get quite heady. It can get even quite ethereal. It's like, oh, thanks, James, for this incredible history lesson. Do you know what I mean? You're like, lots of interesting information. But I want to ground us in this last section. What does it actually mean? How does this work out for us now? And I want to come back to this verse 16 of chapter 4. Because I think for me, it's all in here. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Let me tell you what he's like and why you can trust him and why he can be counted on to understand your deepest struggles and pain. He knows what you're feeling and what you're facing in life. I find verse 15 deeply reassuring. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who's been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. He knows. And I think this is one of the things that when I was studying theology, most captivated me about Jesus. I think his prophetic stuff's amazing, but it was this concept of the incarnation that Jesus came to earth and lived as a human and therefore understood what it was like. He knows what it is to experience temptation. He knows what it is to live in a broken, fallen world. He knows what it is to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane, that moment just before he went to that cross where he was before the Father and he was like, God, take this cup from me. I don't want to do it. Is there any other way to get out of this? And the Lord, and then he has this moment of submission where he says, yet not my will, but yours be done. So even Jesus is sitting there being like, is God, is there any other way? And the Lord's like, no, this is the only way to be the ultimate sacrifice. He knows what it is to be betrayed by those closest to him. We have a high priest who empathizes and understands. And again, it's because we have a high priest who knows what we face and feel in our battle with temptation that we therefore must draw near to the throne of grace when we're in mess and need. And we ask him, it's like, Lord, I just need you to help. Now, the fact is most of Hebrews 5, chapters 5 to 10 is an explanation in great detail of these three verses, which is why I've chosen to anchor myself in here and say, boom, this explains the next five chapters. So I just wanted to talk a little bit more about this idea of approaching the throne of grace. How many of you have cried out in desperation, I just don't know where to turn. I don't know who I can trust. I don't have any place left to go. Where can I find the grace that I need? And here we're told, draw near to the throne of grace. Approach the throne of grace. I don't know what comes into your mind when you envision a throne. We literally just watched the coronation, didn't we? And we saw some pretty glorious things in terms of thrones. Sorry, glorious things. You're going to be like, is he a royalist? Question for another day. What I've learned as a pastor is there's some things that you stay very beige on in life. If somebody approaches you and they're like, I love royalty, you're like, I love you. And if they're like, I hate royalty, you're like, you're amazing. You're all great. We just stand, you sit on the fence. And I'm a sitter on the fence. I really need a drink. Back to the passage. Do you know what? Our author could have said, but didn't say, he didn't say, the throne of God or the throne of heaven. He could have said that. Make no mistake, it's certainly a throne to which we come, but it's a throne of grace. It's a grace that awaits us there. It's grace that sits on the throne. It's not a throne of law or of criticism, but of grace. And the answers to prayer received there are all of grace. And this being a throne of grace means that our prayers will always be heard. Always. And it doesn't matter how feeble they are or how rubbish they are or how incoherent they are, because sometimes when you are in deep distress and need, you do not have the words to pray. There are situations in my life or when I sit with people and they ask me to pray and I literally have no words. It's not about the eloquence of my words. God only looks for humility and desperation in those who would pray to him. So come, ask him for grace to love him, to obey him, to enjoy him. Because this is a gracious throne. God will read your desires without the words. Do you know that he actually doesn't care about your words? We get so wrapped up about it, don't we? It's like, oh, what am I going to pray? In the scriptures, it talks about our hearts groaning. There are moments where we don't know what to pray, and it's like this groaning, this internal groaning that goes on. I think it's why we've been given the gift of tongues, because there are times when it's just like, I don't know what to pray. But Lord, you know that I care about this. God does not care about the eloquence of our prayers. He just cares that you approach the throne room. When we see children pray, it's often the most humbling thing. As I said earlier, I've got three daughters. And when they first learn to pray, they don't know whether, am I praying to the Lord or Jesus or God or Father or... And they stumble over their words. But do you know what? They're some of the most beautiful prayers that you'll ever hear because they're so heartfelt. They're not eloquent, but they're beautiful. I don't think God minds. Do you think he judges us when we come to him, or do you think he's thrilled that we're coming to him? I think that he's thrilled when we come into his presence. Because it's a throne of grace, nothing is required of you but your need of him. The entrance to this throne is not works, but desperation. Doesn't that level the playing field? So we approach him. I want to tell you a story because I want to really illustrate how much the Lord cares about us. And this for me, I was away at a conference 2 weeks ago and was in a warehouse for 5 days. It was very dark. But the Lord did some incredible things. And you know, sometimes you go to a conference and you're like, oh, what is it the Lord's going to say to me? Do you know what? The Lord didn't speak. He did speak to me, but it wasn't about that. It was watching the power of God shift other people's lives that was deeply profound for me. And I want to tell you two stories because I want to show you that God knows and that God cares. I was doing a seminar with my friend Paul, and at the end of the seminar, we had space for some words and pictures. And he gave three prophetic words. These were the three prophetic words. He said, there's somebody in here who has recently lost their sibling. Now, that is a really hard word to give. And I'm not in any sense glorifying this. I think that this is deeply, deeply difficult. But I want to show you how much God cares about us in our pain. There is somebody in here who's recently lost a sibling. The second thing that he said is you either live at number 37 or 73. And the third thing is that it's the word mouth, like Falmouth. That's where you're from. And there was a lady there whose sister had dropped dead the week before. That she lived in number 73 and that she lived in Bournemouth. And then we had an opportunity to minister to this lady. Was it deeply painful? Absolutely. But the thing is that the Lord knows. And so for me, to see that situation, to be able to gather around that person, and that the Lord spoke into her life and he said, I know. The God of all comfort, it talks about in the scriptures. So I had that moment of seeing, and it was really heartrending. Do you know what I mean? This wasn't a glorious ministry moment. This was meeting somebody in the depth of their pain. But in the midst of it, the Lord was like, I see you. I know. And then the second one was I got to pray for somebody else. And I was just praying for them. And we believe in a spiritual world. I believe in a spiritual world, which is that there is the physical world that we see in front of us, but there's also the spiritual world. And in that spiritual world, there's the demonic as well. There is Satan. There is the other side of the enemy. And so I was praying for this person, and I watched a demon leave. And what happened in that moment, there was this breaking of that person. I literally watched it come out. And then the person was completely filled with the Holy Spirit again. And 2 weeks on, that person's completely different. So it's not just about a manifestation of, you know, some people are like, oh, what's going on? Why are they shaking? What's going on? It's like when God meets with people, it can be really, sometimes it's really gentle, still small voice. Sometimes it's really powerful. And I watched that person, and that person loved the Lord. That person was a Christian. And I'm not going into all the theology on the demonic right now, but just to say, something broke off in that moment. I watched it go. And I watched freedom happen in the room. And the point that I'm trying to make to you is this exhortation, it's this encouragement to approach the throne room of God. That he is so gracious. That he calls to us in the midst of, in the deepness of our pain. Also in our joy. I'm not just saying it's in our pain, but in our joy. But this passage is all about he meets us in our needs, isn't it? That's kind of the point that runs through the whole of Hebrews. Under persecution, in difficult situations, the Lord is always there. Access the throne of grace. And secondly, it says, with confidence. How are we to come? Confidence. Confidence in what? Confidence in God. The confidence that comes from knowing that we have a great high priest who knows our thoughts, our hurts, our worst fears, and our deepest desires. Do you ever have these moments where you suddenly realize he knows it all? You know, we have moments where we try and run from the Lord. Have you ever done a Jonah? And you're like, ah, oh, but he does. Oh, he does know. In fact, he knows everything. Now, on the one hand, that can be slightly terrifying. On the other hand, it's deeply reassuring. Because if the Lord knows everything, he knows everything about you. He knows the way that he's made you, the way that he's wired you, and he loves you, and he wants you to come with confidence, not because of confidence that you have in and of yourself, but because of who he is and what he's done. That's the confidence that we're called to have. So approach the throne of, of grace with confidence. And then talks about receiving mercy. So it's grace and mercy. When we come boldly and confidently to the throne of grace in prayer, God doesn't just feel sorry for us. His response isn't, oh my, what a pathetic creature. Because I think sometimes we worry that if we're really real with the Lord, he'll think that we're really pathetic. He doesn't. He doesn't sit there and say, oh, you really got yourself into a mess this time, didn't you? This is the voice that we can have that stops us coming. It's like, but I've struggled with this before. I can't believe that I'm going to come to the Lord with this again. And the Lord is a gracious, beautiful, merciful Father who watches you and sees you. And he's like, come in. I wonder sometimes when you think about, I gave that analogy of approaching the throne. How do you come? What is your posture? And the Lord already spoke to me about this week. And he's like, because there's almost like you can come into the throne. We're talking about the throne room of the King of Kings. And we can come and stand there like an ashamed child. The image that the Lord was giving me is like, just fall to your knees. Just fall to your knees before him. Because he's worthy. It's a beautiful thing to actually surrender yourself before the Lord. Often we talk about surrender being really difficult. And on one hand it is because we've got to get over ourselves. But when we reach the point of surrender and we fall on our knees and we say, Lord, I've got nothing. That's when he loves to fill us. I want to finish with this. He calls us to live humbly from this throne room of grace. I think that we have a choice to live two different ways. You've got a choice to live from the throne room of the Lord, or you've got a choice to live in the world looking at the throne room. Two different things. So the first is like this. If you live in the world and you go occasionally to the throne room, what happens is every time you go into the throne room, you spend all of your time trying to deal with your mess. Can you see how that's, it's like I live in the world, I pick up all this rubbish from the world, and then I go into his throne room and I'm trying to deal with all of my stuff. And I almost spend all of my time repenting because it's like, oh, I haven't been here. Oh, Lord, I'm sorry that I haven't been here. Lord, remember me? Yeah, I'm dealing with this situation in the world. So we've got that choice. You can live here or you can live in the throne room looking at the world. And when we live in the throne room, I believe that's the place. What happens is the attachments of this world begin to break. The things begin to break. We live in the presence of the Lord. I think that's what maturity as a Christian looks like, to learn to live in the throne room. And then things begin to break off us and we look at the world differently. Some of you will know the words of this song, but I think it encapsulates everything that I want to say. It says, turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Can you see how it's all there? The things of earth will grow strangely dim. Why? Because the attachments have been broken in the light of his glory and grace. I want to leave you with this image of coming to the throne room and it being full of grace and mercy. That is your King. Why don't you stand?